did with my advisors on putting disorder in superfoods. So I guess the first thing to know is what exactly do I mean by a superconductor or superfluid? And in our case, it turns out that I guess the difference isn't actually essential, but I guess Landau and Ginsberg worked out a sort of phenomenological theory of superconductivity and superfluidity. And the important thing that they used is they had this expression for the free energy of the superfluid. And the basic idea is that experimentally, you know that once you go below a certain critical temperature, the superfluid will form and it will sort of condense. And you need to have some sort of model that essentially makes that happen. And as you can see, this is the free energy they had, and it has a U1 symmetry. And Patrick actually talked to you earlier about the Mexican hat potential, as it's called. But the basic idea is when T is greater than TC, the minimum stable point on the potential is when this thing is zero. But once you fall below the critical temperature, you can acquire a non-zero vacuum expectation value. And so you're basically rolling off the hill in the middle, I guess, is a nice picture. I don't have one for you right now, but that's basically what you can think of the condensation of the superfluid as. And the important idea is that you're breaking this U1 symmetry in the free energy or Lagrangian, or however you want to think about it. So that's what Landau and Ginsberg worked out. And then later, Bardeen, Cooper, and Schreifer, I believe, developed the BCS theory. And it's basically very successful describing low-temperature superconductors. And the idea is fermions basically bind into little things called Cooper pairs, which behave like bosons. And those condense into like a boson superfluid, which is just your ordinary process of Bose-Einstein condensation. So this basically gives a very good description of low-temperature superconductors and superfluids, but it really doesn't give a great description of high-temperature superconductors. So if you want to start thinking about high-temperature superconductors, I suppose, you have this very generic phase diagram. And this is generally the sales pitch most condensed matter people use for the ADS-CFT. But the general idea is that at this quantum critical point, you have a system that has this sort of scale invariance that comes about. And what that basically means is you can describe the field theory of your system as a CFT, which is a conformal field theory. So that's basically a field theory which has like all your Poincaré symmetries. But then you have a scale invariant symmetry, and then something called a special conformal transformation, which is basically like translation conjugated by an inversion, or the other way around, I think. But so you have these symmetries that arise. But the CFT can also be strongly coupled. And even though you have all these symmetries, it can still be very difficult to study. So what people will tend to do is they use this neat trick called the ADS-CFT correspondence. And it's sort of generalized and maybe abused a little bit because you push a little bit outside these boundaries into studying other things. But the statement is that N equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory is dual to type 2B string theory on ADS-5. And luckily, I don't know any string theory, so you guys won't have to know any either for the presentation. But this statement was given by Maldacena. And the really, I guess, important thing for us is that the generating functional of the CFT is given by the string partition function. Given that the boundary values of the fields match up to the values of the fields in the CFT. So the idea is that you have some sort of bulk gravity description. And if you take, you can take some sort of limits in which this string theory becomes like essentially weakly coupled. And this corresponds to a strongly coupled field theory. So this is really useful because evaluating the partition function of the path integral in a string theory is like ridiculously complicated. So you really can't do it. But if you have a strongly coupled field theory, that's like a weak gravity description. So you can take what's called like the saddle point approximation. And to leading order, that is basically like general relativity. So if you impose this boundary condition where it's just very natural, which is that the bulk values of all the fields in your description, so this is like some gravity fields, some matter fields, and all this stuff goes to the CFT values on the boundary, So technically, you usually have to cut it off at some point because you need some renormalization procedure. But if you do that, you can actually compute the partition function in a strongly coupled field theory just using general relativity, which is very useful because general relativity is something that we understand fairly well. And then I guess, as you can see, you have this dictionary of all this stuff that's true. And not all of these things are independent. You can derive a lot of this stuff from the other. But the general idea is that for every field that you have in ADS space, it corresponds to an operator in the CFT. And this you can compute like expectation values of. And it has a nice physical meaning. And spins match up. So the metric tensor in general relativity basically sources the energy momentum tensor on the boundary. You also have a nice correspondence between masses of fields and scaling dimensions. The scaling dimension is basically how fields in the CFT behave under length changes, which is the scaling symmetry. And then there's also a nice way to put temperature in the CFT, because if you think about a conformal field theory, you can consider conformal field theories of finite temperature. And if you believe in this correspondence, there is a very natural way to put temperature in a field theory from the gravity standpoint, because as Hawking showed and many others showed, black holes have thermodynamic properties. So if you want to consider CFTs at finite temperature, you turn on a black hole in your gravity bulk, and you can do that. So there's this very nice framework for computing observables and expectation functions and correlation functions that you have using the ADS-CFT correspondence. So this allows you to study strongly coupled field theories in a little bit of detail. And as I mentioned earlier, like a high-temperature superconductor would be an example of a strongly coupled field theory. So people began thinking about using this for condensed matter physics some time ago. And I believe in 2008, Hartnall, Horwitz, and Herzog were actually able to come up with a pretty good, I guess what's called a gravity dual to a superconductor superfluid. And I guess I'll try and explain why this works a little bit. So I guess first off, something worth mentioning is that if you want to have a superfluid, you need to have some sort of phase transition where at some high temperature, you have no superfluid, and then at low temperature, you have a bunch of stuff condensing into a superfluid. So to actually have that happen in a gravity description, it's worth thinking about that something called the no-hair theorem. And there's no general no-hair theorem, but people have proved in different cases that it's actually it's a little bit difficult to have fields that are basically non-trivial in a black hole background. Bekenstein, Hawking, and lots of people did work on this. And the basic idea behind the no-hair theorems is that matter would rather either fall into the black hole or propagate out to infinity than actually like sort of forming and having non-zero values in the gravity background. And there's no general no-hair theorem, but it's not easy to find examples of systems that actually have non-zero values for fields. And if you think about the superfluid model, what you actually want is you want at some low temperature in the system, you want to have some sort of condensation of some field, which is forming some non-zero value. So, and actually a simple solution was proposed, I believe, by Gubser. And the general idea was if you add a charge scalar condensate in your bulk, so what that means is you have to couple some charge complex scalar to some Maxwell field, and you notice that you have this U1 symmetry, which is very important. I mean, it's gauged in the bulk, but as I mentioned earlier, you have superfluids have some global U1 symmetry on the boundary. So this is sort of an important thing to have. But the idea is that if you have this charge scalar, when matter tries to fall into the black hole, I guess you can sort of heuristically think about the charge providing some sort of repulsion so it doesn't want to fall in. And then if you consider this term right here, this is just gives you gravity in the bulk. This is like, I guess, your cosmological constant, which gives you your ADS boundary conditions. Well, what happens is when ADS, you can think about it, I guess, as a hyperboloid. If you embed it in, like, I guess it's R24, and that gives you all the symmetry group and stuff like that. But it sort of functions as like a gravitational well, because no massless particles in ADS can actually get to the boundary. So you can sort of think about that as preventing matter from propagating out to infinity. So if you actually combine these two constraints, you can actually get a model which basically reproduces the general behavior, which at low temperature this GTT guy forms this double horizon, so it provides more of an instability. So you could actually potentially have this phase transition. And they proposed this model, which has actually turned out to be very successful. And actually, I'm going to skip ahead for a moment just to show you one of these plots. But you can see that if we have this ADS-CFT prescription, which gives you this formalism for computing expectation values of observables. So you can, this is some operator, and this is essentially dual to the scalar field, which is the charge scalar and the bulk, which you can actually, I mean, in this leading order, you can gauge it to be real. But you can see that it actually does generally reproduce behavior you want, because at this high temperature, you have no condensate, and at this low temperature, you have you actually form a condensate. And so it actually seems to work. And you can also extract other non-trivial things, because if you want to compute some transport properties, these are in general related to two-point functions in the field theory, you can actually compute those if you want to. So here's actually a graph of this conductivity for the electrical conductivity. And you can see that this basically describes lower and lower temperatures. You form this superconducting gap here. And this is exactly what you see in a superconductor. So it basically works. There's actually one other plot I couldn't pull out of a paper that's worth looking at. So this model is actually sort of gives you two models for the price of one for some technical reasons. But this is actually, there's some sort of boundary condition on the psi field you have to specify. And there's two choices. But if you choose the other one, you can actually get these plots for the real and the imaginary part of the conductivity. And these calculations are actually done in the weak gravity limit, I think. So you can even make these a little bit more accurate. But these are actually real plots from graphene. So graphene is roughly described by a 2 plus 1 dimensional CFT. And even though we've sort of broken scale invariance and done some tricky things, which maybe people don't fully agree with, people generally believe in gauge gravity duality. If you look at these plots, they actually look fairly similar. And I think you can make this agreement even more precise if you do these calculations in the not weak gravity limit. And even some of the differences, you can actually explain in the context of the correspondence. So it's actually kind of surprising, because you can actually, it really seems like there's some truth in modeling systems like this. And it also gives you some really strong tools to do that. So you can do a lot more in this ADS-CFT framework than you can do ordinarily. But basically, what you do to solve such a system is you can, you know, pick some ansatz for your bulk system. And I had to work all this out, and I'll explain why when I talk about disorder later. And then you get some, you know, sort of equation of the motion. It's not really that interesting. But you do have to solve these guys numerically, which took me, I guess, an embarrassingly long time. But there's some technicalities, because the differential equations are essentially unstable around the two points you're interested in, which is at the horizon and at the boundary. And the basic way this works out is, in general, you have some like second order differential equation you need to solve. And you have one boundary condition that at the boundary you want them to asymptote to some sort of values, which you can, you know, extract some field theory data off of. But you also have to impose some regularity conditions at the horizon, which is basically to say you don't want things, you know, going to infinity, and you don't want like acausal things happening, like stuff coming out of a black hole. So if you impose these conditions, what you do is there's some symmetries and stuff, but you basically, at the horizon, what you have is you have this value for the psi field, and I guess the electric field, which is the derivative of the gauge field. And then you can plug these in the differential equations, and you propagate it to the boundary. And then you have these fall-offs. And these fall-offs of these fields at the boundary are actually related to the sort of, I guess you could think, the physical values of the expectation things at the boundary. And then you impose some constraints at the boundary. And the ambiguity I mentioned earlier is actually choosing which one of these is zero, which is probably not worth getting into. But you basically have to propagate this data to the boundary, and then use some sort of root-finding method to find which solutions obey that constraint you impose there. So this cuts this down to like a one parameter family of solutions. So what that basically means is these two values determine the temperature of the black hole horizon, which is the temperature of the field theory, and then everything else is fixed. So like you can compute like the expectation value of the charge scalar, which is like how much charge scalar you have as a function of temperature. So this basically fixes everything. So I guess so. What my project was to actually study putting disorder in these field theories, and then studying how the transport properties are affected. So I guess just generally speaking, it's worthwhile thinking about how you put disorder in just an ordinary field theory. And as it turns out, the actual precise weighting of like what distributions you use, because the only way to really do this in a sort of coherent way is to do it statistically, because disorder is a random process. It turns out that the actual weighting is really not that important, things like that. The important thing is you're actually putting disorder in. So it's usually just you pick a Gaussian distribution with some sort of delta function correlation. And if you do that, I mentioned earlier, I guess the basic quantity you want to compute in your field theory is the path integral. And if you can compute the path integral, you can do everything. I mean, you really can't compute path integrals that well, except you can do the Gaussian, I guess. But you really can't do that much more else, except using like perturbation theory and some other tools like that. But what you really need to do is you need to compute this guy. And so the reason why this is hard is because these things are both functions of V. And V is just some sort of probability distribution which you have to integrate over. And this path integral is sort of like a billion dimensional integral over all possible paths in your field theory space. So as it turns out, if you sort of just had one of these guys without this dividing problem, you could actually get somewhere. But if you think about how do you average over this disorder when you have this sort of division happening here, you really can't do much. And so this is a problem that I don't think anybody's found a like direct solution to. And so there are a few tricks to do this. And one of these is called the replica trick, which is basically a sort of way to kick this guy into the numerator. And my mentors have, I believe, done some research on this or are doing some research on this. But it's still not really that easy. And as I mentioned earlier, ADCFT gives you a tool to compute path integrals, I guess, in some manner of speaking. But this disorder still makes it a little bit tricky to compute things. So I guess another thing, so the way that I actually worked on putting disorder in this model was using something called a memory function formalism. And ironically, we actually don't need to use the actual memory function in the formalism. But basically, the way this works is if you have some sort of Hamiltonian in your field theory, and then you perturb it, and that's by adding some what's called a relevant operator coupled to some disorder in the field theory. And so CFTs, I guess, are a little bit strange in some ways, because things like S matrices and other things aren't really defined. But operators are well defined, and computing expectation values of operators are well defined. So you couple what's called the most relevant operator to that. And it's basically, that's just some like statement in the renormalization group language that in some limit, which we want to study it in, which is the low frequency limit. So I showed you the plots earlier of the conductivity. And if we're interested in studying the low frequency limit, we need to study operators in that regime. But I guess I can talk about that later. But basically, the way this works is if you perturb the Hamiltonian by this quantity, you can start computing Green's functions, which are two-point functions. And we can do this pretty well in the ADS-CFT framework. But the way disorder plays into this is you basically can derive all these formulas. And the derivations aren't really that complicated. But if you're interested in computing momentum density, for example, which is if you have a GTX in the bulk, which corresponds to some TTX, which is like a momentum flux in the field theory, and you want to compute a two-point function of that, you can basically use this formalism to compute disordered two-point functions of that. It really only works for that because the momentum flux has a conserved charge. So it seems like the simplest thing to choose, but you can basically work out all these relations because you know that the momentum operator, you know, acts like a derivative, and you have all these relations. So you can work all this stuff out, but at the end of the day, you get these two relations, which are the most important. And F here, I forgot to write down, is basically the commutator of the momentum operator with your coupled to your relevant operator. And what this is basically telling you is that, these two are exact expressions. But if you assume disorder is weak and that you could, you know, in some weak limit, expand all these expressions in powers of V bar squared, where V bar squared is like some length scale in your Gaussian distribution, which is your disorder, then what you find is actually that if you want to compute two-point functions of momentum density, you have this V squared, which trivially factors out here. Now, this is actually like an exact factorization if you assume all the Gaussian stuff. If you were to expand this guy out, then the leading order term here is like not disordered. So you could evaluate that and your background, which has no disorder, which, as I showed you earlier, we actually, people have done and is a doable thing. And if you compute this two-point function at non-zero momentum and frequency, then you can get the, at leading order, the disordered two-point function for this guy, which is, you know, given by this expression as a function of this. So it basically is a nice little trick, and it allows you to basically get some information perturbatively about how disorder is affecting the transport properties of momentum density without actually, I guess, putting disorder in some sense, because you're just evaluating stuff in the translation invariant background, which you actually know how to do. So it's kind of a neat little trick, and there's, I guess, some subtleties with the contact term, but it's not really worth maybe mentioning. But so I mentioned earlier, you have to add this operator O in the field theory. So I guess you have to, there's some ambiguity about how you define that. But if you sort of want to do this in maybe the most right way, the right thing to do would be to couple disorder directly to the psi field, because this psi field is the actual thing that condenses. It's really the superfluid. So it seems more natural to actually couple psi to that field. But what that basically means is, in these expressions you can derive, these things are actually non-local in K. So what you have to do is you have to consider perturbations at non-zero momentum and non-zero frequency, and then somehow integrate out the K variable. And if you actually work this out for the psi variable, the equations are basically like horrifically complicated. So it turns out to be not that tricky, but it makes these equations sort of look like a harmonic oscillator problem. So it's not really that easy to do. I mean, in principle, it's doable. It's something I'm actually working on doing right now. But there's a sort of quick and dirty way to do that, which is you just introduce some extra scalar field as a perturbation. And the sort of physical interpretation of that is you have some sort of condensate, which is interacting with some extra matter, which is interacting with the disorder. So it's some sort of indirect coupling, I guess. And I know it sounds a little bit sketchy, but it's at least doable. And the concerning the perturbations at non-zero momentum and frequency is very easy to do. So I can introduce this parameter in, and you know, I can run it through this sort of memory function formalism we have, and then I can start to compute conductivities and stuff for this parameter. And I don't know why these plots are so light, but okay. So what you're basically going to find is, if you start computing these corrections, what you'll find is that not surprisingly, at low temperature, the disorder is not doing as much. These curves are basically at higher and higher temperatures. And what you're basically finding is that this two-point function G, this GPP guy behaves linearly near the boundary of low frequency, which is the infrared limit, which is the one we're interested in. And the reason why we're interested in that limit is because classically you have this translation invariant divergence there, so it's interesting to see what happens when you put disorder in. But if you have this linear behavior right here, and you divide by this omega squared, and then you divide by that omega, what you're going to get roughly near the boundary is some sort of curve, which is also divergent, but is falling off like 1 over omega squared. And what that's basically sort of telling you is there's actually a sort of nice physical interpretation of this. These plots are bigger. I guess you can see. I mean, maybe it doesn't mean much right now. But if you go back to this very, very, very crude, I guess, Drude model, and I guess this model is very simple. It's basically trivial to solve. But it's basically, if you write Newton's law for like an electron or something, and you have some external electric field, which is basically the same thing as our gauge field, and then you put some sort of velocity-dependent damping, this is a problem you guys all know how to solve. It's very easy to solve. But if you consider some perturbations of the electric field at zero momentum, you'll get this Drude model. And what the Drude model essentially tells you is that this sort of tau parameter, which is your relaxation time, essentially damps out this omega equals zero divergence. And I guess you'll get a nice, more regular curve, which looks like that. And this is sort of what you might expect in a very heuristic way when you put disorder in any system. But if you take this Drude model, And then if you see if you can expand out this denominator in some, you know, dimensionless way where you take tau to be very large, which is the relaxation time, so that's like the natural parameter in this system, you'll actually get that leading order correction is like roughly proportional to 1 over omega squared. And it's actually interesting because holographically, if you compute the thermal conductivity without disorder, you actually get a very simple answer. You don't need to solve any difference equations or anything like that. I mean, for the electrical conductivity, you do have to do something more complicated. But you'd still have this sort of, this real delta function in the real part. But our correction is also 1 over omega squared in this perturbation of holographic system. So it's actually kind of interesting to see that because, a priori, there's no reason that you, maybe this is debatable, but there's no reason to think that the Drude model might make the same prediction. But it's sort of nice to see that it has a nice physical interpretation. And it also does, although this is kind of trivial, it does the right thing. Higher temperatures, basically disorder does more. And this is sort of very natural. Superconductors have this. So it's nice to see that it also does this in our model. And what would really be a nice non-trivial prediction would be to actually construct some measure of the disorder. For example, you could take the slopes of these lines at near omega equals 0, and you could plot it as a function of temperature. And based on the three cases that I've done, I know it's actually nonlinear. I only got all the numerics working recently, so I haven't had that much time. But that would be a non-trivial prediction of ADS-CFT. That would tell you, essentially, at least at perturbative order, how disorder would be affecting the system as a function of temperature. So there's actually, even though it matches with this sort of Drude model, which has this nice physical interpretation, there are definitely some interesting things you can do. So I guess in conclusion, what we have is that adding this perturbative disorder sort of agrees with this crude Drude model. Also, I guess maybe I didn't mention this earlier, but if you look at the slopes on these lines, I mean, I know you can't really see well, but these slopes are all very small in some sort of dimensionless units, I guess. So I guess it means like the disorder is in some sense weak. So I don't actually know too much about this, but I think there's some paper by Anderson which says that disorder shouldn't do much to superconductors or something like that. So I guess in a very sort of qualitative way, it sort of agrees with that. I guess I just mentioned this, but you can also extract the temperature dependence from holography, which is something that I should basically do next, and that would be a non-trivial prediction of ADS-CFT. And then the last thing is consider the direct coupling of disorder to the order parameter in the system. The order parameter in the system is the thing that's actually condensing in the superfluid. That seems more physical. I mean, the equations are much more complicated, so it's not immediately clear that you'll even get the same behavior as this system, but hopefully it'll be qualitatively similar. But it may even give some other non-trivial predictions. But even though the equations are messy, I think it may be doable because there are some, maybe a few simplifications you can make. So I guess that's it. So thanks for you all for listening and my advisors for proposing the idea and helping me understand all this stuff. And of course, for PI for giving us this opportunity. No questions. OK.
Can you explain the two glasses a little bit better?
Oh, yeah, okay, yes. Oh, yeah, sorry. I don't even know if I show these to you guys. Yeah. Okay, so basically what these plots are this is the real part of the momentum conductivity normalized, and then this is as a function of frequency, which has also been normalized. And so these plots basically show the our perturbative correction to the momentum conductivity as a function of frequency. And these are as a function of increasing temperature. So this is like a very low temperature curve, which is like, you know, you could say this being like point, this is like 0.1 in some dimensionless units. This is like 1 and this is like 2. And so this is basically this is just the momentum conductivity, which is what we wanted to compute. And it has the right 1 over omega squared behavior, which is our perturbative correction. So I guess one thing is we have this sort of annoying UV divergence, which will eventually kick in. But we can actually just look at some general properties of this curve, and we can probably extract the temperature dependence off of these. And the second plot is just the two-point function of the extrascalar field we introduced in, very near the omega equals zero limit as a function of the frequency. And so this is, again, this is for the low temperature, the medium temperature, and the high temperature. So I'm hoping that I can just fit the slopes on these and then plot the slopes as a function of temperature, which is, I guess, gives some idea of how the disorder is affecting the system as a function of temperature. So I think that would be a nice plot to make, but I haven't gotten that far yet, because you have to actually get one of these plots, what you have to do is you have to solve a difference equation over two-dimensional parameter space. So basically over a whole bunch of numbers for omega and k, and then integrate out the k after you've gotten to the boundary, and then you extract the data off the boundary, and then plot it as a function of omega. So it's not like super speedy to construct these plots. I mean, it's still definitely easier than like trying to do things in strongly coupled field theory, but it's not trivial, I guess, to make these plots and do all the numerics. But I guess, yeah. The two-point function of the scalar field?
The comparison with Grafene.
Wait, what?
This other plot in this other paper where they have plots of Grafene.
Oh, the graphene plots. Oh, the graphene plots. Oh, damn, where'd that go? Okay. That's no good. Wait, okay, I think I can get this online. Okay, what is it? I think it's this guy that did it. This is in the paper. So these are some review notes on this holography stuff. Okay, so... I don't know. I guess, can people see this? What is this? Okay. No, that's not really much better. But I guess everybody can see what's happening. So what this basically is this is the electrical conductivity. I think these calculations are also done in the weak gravity approximation. But this is for the conformal dimension 2 operator. So in my case, I did it for the dimension 1 operator. I haven't gotten the numerics to work yet for the other dimension operator. But this is the real part of the conductivity and the imaginary part of the conductivity, you know, as a function of omega over t. And then these are plots for graphene. And then the one on the top for graphene roughly corresponds to the one on the left for the conductivity. The one on the right corresponds to the one on the bottom. And I know the comparisons aren't like exactly numerically correct, and you definitely wouldn't want to bet anything valuable on the numbers matching up. But the qualitative behavior is similar, and he gives this discussion later of like why the differences might be there, and it's actually a pretty convincing argument that he makes. And also, I think if you did these plots in the not weak gravity limit, the comparison would be even better. But I think this is actually, these plots aren't in the original paper they wrote. I think he even says this is the first time that they do this. But the comparison is pretty nice. Have you not seen these before? What do you mean? What do you say about?
What kind of if it was the
Yeah, it was just the rough shape. I think he gives some discussion later on about like why some differences might be there, but so yeah, but yeah, he talks about it in the review article. Yeah, but. For this one? Yeah, I think there has to be, because the imaginary part diverges. So by the Kramers-Kronig thing, you have to have the delta function at the origin.
Just numerically.
Yeah, numerically you can't pick it up, but.
The imaginary part of it is also diverging the real stuff.
Oh, it is? Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, here, yeah. I mean, obviously, I guess experimentally, you can't go to arbitrary low frequencies either. Just like you can't do it numerically. But yeah, that's sort of interesting. Because, I think that, so the translation, I think they even talk about it, whereas if you're above the, so the model's translation variance, so you always have the delta function at omega equals zero, but I think they give some discussion, well, we're above the critical temperature, it's because you have translation variance, but below, I think, in the paper they wrote, they actually give some, you know, description in terms of the Higgs mechanism or something like that. So I think they argue that that's why it's there in the below the temperature thing, even though it's going to be there anyways, I guess, because this is a translation variance, but I guess.
Can you get to graphene just because it's 2+1?
Well, yeah, I think graphene because it's a 2+1 dimensional CFT. I mean, I think it's also the only thing you can actually, people have done experiments on, so.
What about the standard high temperature superconductors?
Huh?
Against these high temperature superconductors?
Oh, I don't know. I have no idea. I don't even know why. I think maybe they don't have the data yet. I mean, also, all this
maybe
stuff is.
Super,
yeah. Maybe it doesn't fit that well. It's also true, but I'm not sure. But I think also I've looked online and getting a plot like this as a function of frequency, they don't actually have much data like this. Because what you really want to compare is the perturbation as a function of frequency. And I think this is really the only plot I've been able to find like this. Everything else gives you some temperature dependence and, you know, some experimental parameters, but there's nothing that actually perturbs as a function of frequency. So maybe that's another reason. But yeah. Okay, I guess that's it.